so much for this kind invitation to this series. Thank you all for coming. I'm a little overwhelmed, I'll be honest, by this huge crowd. And also for me, as you were just told, I'm from the Department of American Studies, so you are a completely new target audience and crowd. So I'm very excited what you think about, what political, among others, political science students think about what I have to say about this year's election. On July 1st in 2024, the United States Supreme Court finally issued its decision on the highly anticipated presidential immunity case, or as it is actually called, Trump v. United States. But despite what most legal scholars predicted, the 6-3 majority opinion penned by Chief Justice John Roberts gives presidents broad immunity when it comes to actions performed during their term in the White House. This was a huge win for the plaintiff, former President Donald Trump, in his attempt to fight the criminal charges leveled against him in connection to his effort to overturn a 2020 presidential election. This ruling has complicated the case brought by the Justice Department. While it makes a conviction not impossible, only more difficult, it ensures that despite the fact that the actions in question happened almost 4 years ago and the indictment was issued in August of 2023, this court case will be further delayed and definitely not resolved before Election Day on November 5th. Notably, this Supreme Court decision came down, as happens so often these days, along ideological lines. The 6 conservative justices, 3 of whom were actually appointed by Trump himself, sided with him. The 3 liberal justices dissented. During oral arguments that took place in April, we could listen, and we can only listen to it because the cameras are not allowed in the Supreme Court. So we could listen to some mind-boggling exchanges. Now, those among you who don't follow US politics as closely as I do, well, for one, good for you. I'm sure you have a more pleasant life than I do. But also, you may be wondering, why is the US Supreme Court debating whether a president can legally assassinate his political rival in the year 2024? Excellent question. How did we get here and what does this mean? So what I would like to do here tonight is trying to in part answer these 2 questions. I want to explore how Trump got elected 8 years ago, and particularly the big part the media played in it. And looking ahead, I want to lay out for you why I and many others think that he poses an actual threat to democracy in the United States now. So first, let's jump back in time a bit. As I explained in an article a few years ago, in 1969, the US historian Daniel J. Boorstin described and lamented the ways the United States built, quote, the thicket of unreality which stands between us and the facts of life, unquote. He argues that the origins of this unreality are what he coined as pseudo-events, which are, in a nutshell, news stories that are artificially created. According to him, pseudo-events do not happen spontaneously, but are planned in advance in ways that ensure that the media can easily relate them to the public. Interestingly, Boorstin's prime example of a pseudo-event, the interview, is something that has become so normal and is so frequently used that most of us could probably not imagine the news landscape without it. Boorstin argues that unlike, for example, a natural disaster, the interview is a clear instance where news is being made rather than merely reported. And it is this news making, that is to say the creation of pseudo-events, that lies at the heart of society's self-deception. Quote, participants, Boorstin explains, are selected for their newsworthy and dramatic interest, unquote. It is all about performance instead of substance, which makes pseudo events instantly more accessible to people than ordinary events. As Boorstin remarks, quote, even if we cannot discuss intelligently the qualifications of the candidates or the complicated issues, we can at least judge the effectiveness of a television performance, unquote. The fact that much of post-presidential debate coverage on cable news and elsewhere does not discuss policies, but usually deliberates at length about which of the candidates won the debate, confirms this observation. Besides the pseudo event, Boorstin's biggest and closely related lament involves the excesses of celebrity culture. Celebrities are artificially produced the same way pseudo-events are. In fact, Borstein calls celebrities human pseudo-events. Since people hold celebrities in such high regard, however, they frequently refuse to acknowledge the ties between celebrity and artificiality. What Borstein finds most troubling about this is that, identical to the way pseudo-events pull public attention toward them and away from spontaneous events, celebrities tend to eclipse heroes. Consequently, all society is left with are people who are famous for being famous. Donald Trump was and is a big celebrity with a big name. In fact, he appears to be the ultimate and one of the most deliberate human pseudo-events. Given that he spent his entire life carefully cultivating a certain image of himself in the media that lacks any kind of footing in reality. Already in 1987, Trump published his best-selling advice tract, The Art of the Deal, in which he explains to his readers how to become as rich as he is. According to Trump biographer, as well as longtime outspoken critic Timothy O'Brien, Trump claimed he was a billionaire in a conversation with him as early as 1996 and asserted that he had increasing, albeit fluctuating, amounts of money throughout the following years. When he announced his candidacy for president in 2015, he claimed to be worth $8.7 billion. Only 1 month later, however, he upped the financial disclosure report, which presidential candidates are required to fill with the Federal Election Commission, to around $10 billion. But it was not enough for Trump to have people believe he is very rich. He is also adamant about having done it by himself. During a town hall appearance during the 2016 campaign, he boasted a small loan of $1 million. And we're talking the 1980s or something, or even earlier, right? What all this already hints at is that Trump's image of the self-made billionaire is almost entirely grounded in performance and spectacle, and not really in substance. Then in 2018, a New York Times article gave a detailed account on how Trump's own origin story of the self-made man was nothing short of fiction. Instead of the small loan, his father, in fact, provided him with what amounted to the equivalent of $413 million, adjusted for inflation, over 5 decades. From effectively earning a salary from his father's real estate empire since he was 3 years old, Trump could always rely on his father's support. While many of his business failures and questionable net worth had already been sporadically exposed throughout most of his career, long before his campaign announcement, such reports intensified once he became a serious presidential contender and then during his presidency. One aspect that adds to the bewilderment about Trump getting away with portraying himself as a masterful dealmaker and singular businessman for so long is that it does not actually really require investigative journalism to at least pierce that facade. He bankrupted casinos in Atlantic City and generally suffered at least 6 bankruptcies throughout his career. Additionally, by merely reviewing the many products and business opportunities that Trump has touted over the years, the smokescreen all but disappears. In no particular order, there once was a board game called Trump the Game, the men's fragrance, Donald Trump the Fragrance, men's suits from Donald J. Trump's signature collection, the bottled water Trump Ice, Trump Airline, Trump Steaks, and Trump Magazine. None of them are anymore. Trump University, yes, was entangled in a class action lawsuit in which former students accused Trump and the university of fraud. The judge approved a $20 million settlement. In another particularly shameful setback to the Trump empire, Donald J. Trump Foundation, the supposed charity organization of the Trump family, was forced to dissolve under court supervision in 2018, which was the result of a lawsuit brought by the New York Attorney General. And yet, despite all these and more, trust me, failures and uncovered lies, Trump's image as business tycoon has remained largely, and for his supporters, evidently completely intact. As this brief survey of Trump's life as a businessman illustrates, his image as self-made billionaire, unmatched dealmaker, and real estate mogul is not grounded in reality. Therefore, in a way, he is really only known for being a self-made billionaire, an unmatched dealmaker, and real estate mogul. Of course, reality matters very little when reality television comes into play. All of Trump's self-marketing culminated in 2004, when The Apprentice premiered. For those of you who aren't familiar, the simple premise of The Apprentice was that a group of contestants compete by doing business-related tasks. In each episode, one of them is eliminated at the end, which gave Trump his very own catchphrase. Well, when you may look down on this show, considering this kind of competitive reality television as one of the lowest forms of entertainment, I would, it should not be underestimated just how much of an impact The Apprentice had on Trump's image and subsequent successful presidential candidacy. While he had been somewhat of a celebrity even before that, The Apprentice turned him into a big TV star right from the start. The show had high ratings, was broadcast for several seasons, and helped cement his image as world-class businessman. Wrong as it may be. In Laurie Ouellette and Jim Hayes' analysis of The Apprentice, they use a critical verb in their description of Trump's role in the show. Quote, at the center of the series, as judge, boss, manager, series owner, and exemplar, is Donald Trump, which the series casts as arguably the most recognizable U.S. entrepreneur and mogul of the late 20th century, unquote. The importance of this phrasing can hardly be overstated. Donald Trump was cast in The Apprentice and did not create it. He merely played the role of a highly successful businessman. The show made him look powerful, assertive, decisive, and always in charge. It was all about money and how to become rich. Now, besides this striking opening sequence, the most important scenes of the show were the ones that were set to take place in the boardroom of Trump Organization, high up in the famous Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan that you can see on the slide here. Misha Kafka, in her article on Trump and reality television, explains how The Apprentice featured a studio version of Trump's own boardroom. Studio version being the operative word. According to O'Brien, this was neither the actual boardroom, nor did it in any way approximate the real office space of Trump Organization that he describes as, quote, a tad run down and worn, surprisingly vacant, unquote. O'Brien furthermore, and perhaps more importantly, points out that despite its reputation, Trump Organization is in essence a fairly small operation with only a few employees. In other words, in real life, Trump was not a CEO of a huge company with board members and shareholders to answer and report to, but instead was the head of what was essentially a family business. So Trump's persona as powerful CEO, like the boardroom, was a deception made for television. To appropriate Borstein's terminology, he was a pseudo-CEO in a pseudo-boardroom. What Kafka astutely elaborates upon in her article, though, was the importance of the setup of the boardroom scenes. Trump, usually with advisors or associates by his side, always sat at the long end of a big conference table opposite the contestants, awaiting his verdict on their performance. As Kafka highlights, this is not what an actual boardroom looks like, but to Trump, this unrealistic depiction was of little importance. In fact, by the mere virtue of this television portrayal, this setup becomes familiar and therefore real. Additionally, facilitated by the fact that most people do not have access to actual boardrooms. What is particularly interesting about this is that Trump himself may have believed all along or ended up believing that this is, in fact, how strong leaders talk to their subordinates and brought this view all the way into the White House. In a higher loyalty, James Comey, the former director of the FBI, who was fired by Trump only 4 months into his presidency, describes his handful of encounters with Trump in great detail. Among other things, what struck him about their meetings in the Oval Office was that President Trump always sat behind the Resolute desk, and everybody else had to sit in a semicircle on the opposite side. The reason Comey found this conspicuous was that it was contrary to the experience with the two other US presidents under whom he served and with whom he had meetings in the Oval Office, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. At least whenever Comey was present, neither of those two presidents ever sat behind the desk in order to conduct a meeting, but always chose to gather in the sitting area with them sitting in the armchair by the fireplace. Comey assumed that they did this deliberately in order to make people more comfortable, reduce the hierarchical distance that everybody automatically has with the president, given the great authority of this office, and thus make it easier for them to tell the president the truth. Trump preferred the opposite approach, as Comey recounts, quote, "When the president sits on a throne, protected by a large wooden obstacle, as Trump routinely did in my interactions with him, the formality of the Oval Office is magnified and the chances of getting the full truth plummet," unquote. Unlike former presidents, Trump apparently felt the constant need to heighten his power and project his authority, and he did this the only way he knew how. The way it was done in The Apprentice, thus turning the Oval Office into a made-for-TV boardroom, even during classified meetings without any cameras. Others in Trump's orbit, too, have acknowledged that Trump has tried to replicate the aesthetics from The Apprentice for other occasions. Jonathan Brown, the editorial supervisor for the first few seasons of The Apprentice, explained that Trump's now infamous campaign announcement in 2015, where he came down the escalator in Trump Tower, do you remember that, I hope, and proclaimed that Mexican immigrants were all, you know, murderers and rapists. That was a technique they frequently used on the show. Justin McCarney, who worked as a media director for Trump Organization for several years, revealed that Trump's number one instruction was always to shoot him like they did on The Apprentice, because this was his preferred look. Clearly, Trump was very concerned about his visual appearance, but how much Trump was actually part of the decision-making process when it came to which contestant would be fired and why is a subject of considerable dispute. Brown described how the editors were repeatedly forced to reverse engineer an episode because Trump made the decision to fire somebody on the spur of the moment without considering who had performed well throughout the week. Clay Aiken, a former contestant on Celebrity Apprentice, on the other hand, claimed that Trump did not decide who was fired at all, but that that decision was made by the producers of the show. Admittedly, Aiken was the only one to publicly make that accusation, but it does seem plausible given that this is how reality shows usually work. As is well known, I hope I'm not breaking news here now, the name of the genre is a misnomer. Reality television is scripted to a large extent, and it would make sense if the show's producers were to base their decisions about who to eliminate on a variety of factors, including some that are unrelated to how the contestants handled their business-related tasks, such as their popularity with viewers and how their actions and personalities helped shape an interesting narrative arc for the individual episodes as well as the entire season. In fact, Mark Burnett, the show's producer and mastermind, dislikes the term reality television and prefers to use dramality, a portmanteau of drama and reality, with which he at least implicitly concedes how important he considers the manipulation of reality in order to create and enhance drama in the genre of, in this genre of television. Whichever side one believes, whether Trump made the decisions badly or not at all, they both plainly undermine the image of Trump as brilliant decision maker. While experienced government officials easily saw through this performative act in the Oval Office, it was all the more convincing to the viewers of The Apprentice. As Kafka stresses, the manner in which these boardroom scenes were orchestrated presented Trump as a calm and self-assured decision maker. The show put on a weekly display of how Trump alone can fix it and also extended this appeal and celebrity far beyond the East Coast. As Trump biographers Michael Cranish and Mark Fisher pointed out, The Apprentice also connected him to Middle America. All of a sudden, more and more people noticed him on the street, and their attitude towards him was overwhelmingly positive. Trump's character in The Apprentice may have contributed to giving him undue credibility and media attention when he helped stage a pseudo-event which came to be known as birtherism. In other words, claiming that Barack Obama was not born in the US, so not a natural-born US citizen, and thus not a legitimate president. This catapulted Trump onto the political path that was to lead to his first serious presidential candidacy. In February of 2011, he spoke for the first time at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, an annual gathering of the who is who of the Republican Party. There, as he had done repeatedly in the past, he hinted at a presidential run, but nobody took it too seriously. Most people thought that Trump was simply trying to use this platform to increase viewership numbers of his TV show that had suffered from a ratings decrease after so many years. What received little attention at the time, but is significant in retrospect, is that this also marks the first time Trump lent his voice to birtherism. Soon, Trump would flood the media landscape with his unfounded suspicions about President Obama's birthplace. He tweeted relentlessly on the subject and went on every television show that would have him, demanding that Obama, the president at the time, publicly release his birth certificate. And it was not just far-right fringe websites or generally conservative media outlets that helped him spread this already, at the time, repeatedly debunked conspiracy theory. One has to wonder why so many mainstream news and news adjacent shows gave him a platform to spread this conspiracy theory they already knew was untrue. Why did they keep asking him about claims that had long been repeatedly debunked? He was not an expert in the field, whichever this field would even be, and at the time he wasn't even running for office yet. So why did the media give any voice to a reality television host's opinion on Obama's birthplace? The simple answer is, because it made news. And importantly, it does not matter that the host of mainstream news and talk shows challenged him, corrected his claims, and even criticized him for them. Simply by giving Trump a platform, by letting him repeat false claims and announce future shocking revelations, and by repeating these false claims and potential new allegations themselves, even in the context of disproving them, the journalists aided Trump in co-manufacturing the pseudo-event that was birtherism. Once Trump announced his candidacy in 2015, he used the same tactics and profited from the same dynamics with the media that had elevated an originally only fringe conspiracy theory to a national controversy. Even though only very few took his presidential run seriously for many months, every one of the outrageous assertions he made on the campaign trail was reported, discussed, and replayed ad nauseum. His rally speeches were often carried live in full because they generated ratings. Leslie Moonves, the former CEO of CBS, openly admitted how good Trump was for them financially. Quote, "The money's rolling in and this is fun. I've never seen anything like this. And this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going." Unquote. The media profited financially, and so did Trump. Now, to pivot quite a bit, what Trump also greatly profited from is the arguably undemocratic way the US elects its president. As I hope members of the audience, we will find out now, will know, in the United States, the presidential election is not decided by the popular vote, but by the so-called Electoral College. Let us briefly revisit, though, how these electors are distributed to see how this affects party political dynamics. Every state receives as many electors and thus votes in the Electoral College as they have members in the United States Congress. While the number of members in the House of Representatives is proportionate to the population, every state also has two senators, regardless of how many people live in that state. This means that on the one end of the spectrum, California, with almost 40 million inhabitants, receive 52 electors. They have 50 House representatives and two senators. And on the other end of the spectrum, Wyoming, with less than 600,000 inhabitants, gets three electors. They have one House member and also two senators. This means that a single Californian elector represents almost 770,000 people, while one elector from Wyoming represents less than 200,000. Consequently, a vote cast in Wyoming would actually be equal to almost four in California, which would in turn need approximately 200 electors for its population to be represented equally to that of Wyoming. Clearly, one of the most basic democratic principles, one person, one vote, is not the governing standard here. Less populated states have disproportionate power in the federal government, and not just when it comes to choosing the next president. Of course, that, quote, "the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state," unquote, and, quote, "each state shall appoint a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress," unquote, is enshrined in the United States Constitution. It has given small and or low population states disproportionate power since the country's founding. But as Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Seiblet explain in their Tyranny of the Minority, the dynamics of who the system favors have changed drastically over time. According to them, two developments were decisive. For one, the gap between low and high population states widened considerably over time, which therefore also increases the disparity of power. For another, by 1920, the United States became a majority urbanized country, which led to the most populous also being the most urbanized states. Consequently, quote, what began as a strictly small state bias had become a rural state bias, unquote. As Levitsky and Seiblet are quick to point out, though, this changed makeup of the country still does not favor one political party over another. For much of the 20th century, the split between the Republican and Democratic parties was not based on the rural-urban divide. Both had supporters in both camps. But this eventually changed, as Levitsky and Seiblet write, quote, with the rise of the post-industrial knowledge economy, urban centers have become engines of economic dynamism and good jobs, while rural areas and older manufacturing centers have stagnated. At the same time, immigration has increased the ethnic and cultural diversity of many of these dynamic urban centers, unquote. This development resulted in left-leaning parties becoming more popular in cities and right-leaning parties being dominant in small towns and rural areas. And this trend did not just happen in the United States, but in many Western democracies. A US-specific change in voter behavior, on the other hand, was caused by the Civil Rights Movement. Before the adoption of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act in the 1960s, voters in the rural South preferred the Democratic Party, while the majority of people in the rural North voted Republican. Afterwards, the former, primarily the white people among this group, though, quickly moved towards the Republicans, a change which was likely aided by the so-called Southern Strategy. That is to say, the Republicans' active embrace of Southern Democratic voters who disagreed with the achievements of the Civil Rights Movement. Following that period, rates remained relatively stable for the next 25 years. In The Left Behind, Decline and Rage in Rural America, Robert Wuthner observes the same shift in party support. While in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan still managed to receive votes from both rural and urban areas, the divide between large cities and suburbs backing Democratic presidential candidates and small towns supporting Republican candidates has been growing consistently since then. Trevor E. Brown and Suzanne Mettler's extensive study on the rural-urban political divide shows just how rapidly this split emerged. From the Republican Richard Nixon to the Democrat Bill Clinton, the difference between votes from the two areas was insignificant and remained largely the same. However, starting in 2000, the two sides have kept moving further away from each other with every election cycle. According to Brown and Mettler, quote, the gulf between them has grown from the just 2 percentage points as recently as 1992 to 21 by 2020, unquote. The result of all these historical developments is that US federal elections are skewed in favor of the Republican Party. Even if and when the Democrats receive a majority of actual votes cast nationally, this does not necessarily translate to a Democratic president or a majority in the Senate. As Levitsky and Seiblet summarize, quote, the Constitution's small state bias, which became a rural bias in the 20th century, has become a partisan bias in the 21st century, unquote. In 2014, Barack Obama made a pointed joke about these structural disadvantages of high population states and the Democratic Party. When asked by a supporter how they could help him, he quipped, move to North Dakota. If I could just get about 1 million surplus vote from here in Brooklyn out to Nebraska or Wyoming, unquote. Besides Democratic votes, what would also increase in Nebraska and Wyoming if such a collective move were to take place is the racial and ethnic diversity of their populations. Even the rural counties have become less white over time. At only 24%, people of color are still the clear minority, with a share that is well below the whole country's, which is at about 42%. As a result, white voters have disproportionate structural power in Washington. This problem is compounded by the fact that the five inhabited U.S. territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, U.S. Virgin Islands, and the Northern Mariana Islands, have no representation in the Senate and only non-voting members in the House, and do not get to participate in the presidential election. What they do have is a high non-white population. In Puerto Rico, for instance, only 17.1% are white. And with over 3 million inhabitants, this single territory is bigger than 19 of the 50 US states. And while the District of Columbia, aka Washington, DC, whose majority of inhabitants are of color, does get three electors in the Electoral College, they, like the US territories, have no representation in the Senate either. This has devastating consequences for how people of color are represented in the federal government. According to a New York Times report that was provocatively titled "The Senate, Affirmative Action for White People," the Senate gives, quote, "the Senate gives the average black American only 75% as much representation as the average white American. The average Asian American has 72% as much representation as a white person, and the average Hispanic American only 55% as much," unquote. The election of Donald Trump in 2016 encapsulated all these dynamics at play. As is commonly known, he lost the popular vote against Hillary Clinton by almost 3 million votes, and yet won the Electoral College and became president. The same may happen again this time around. I'm also not sure the media coverage of him has improved all that much, or at least enough. What has been a curious through line in his media coverage is that his speeches, statements, and posts are often interpreted rather than simply reported. Do you remember what happened in 2016, what we saw, heard, and read on the news? When Trump says he wants to build a wall along the southern border, what he really means is that he intends to crack down on illegal immigration. When he calls for a Muslim ban, he's not talking about all Muslims and certainly does not propose an actual ban. He's merely championing strict immigration laws. When he, joined by his supporters, chants "lock her up" in reference to Hillary Clinton, he does not intend to actually abuse his power as president in order to prosecute his political opponents, but this is a simple expression of the notion that nobody is above the law. Trump's tenure as president, however, quickly showed that he should have been taken more literally. He meant to build a wall. He failed. He meant to implement a Muslim ban. He did. He meant to prosecute his political opponents. He tried and failed. Turns out he also meant it when he said weeks, even months before Election Day in 2020, that should he not win, the election was rigged. Generally under Trump, extreme rhetoric became much more mainstream in political discourse. Mainstream media became fake news and even the enemy of the people. Election opponents and perceived political enemies were accused of treason, which in the US is punishable by death. Korea government employees became the deep state. The Democrats became the radical left. And Don Jr., Trump's eldest son, repeatedly promised on the campaign trail in 2020 that they would make liberals cry again. During a 2020 presidential debate, Trump told the white supremacist group, the Proud Boys, to, quote, "stand back and stand by." In the first year of his presidency, he saw fine people during a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, you know, among people who chanted, I quote, "Jews will not replace us," unquote. He said the Republican and outspoken Trump critic Liz Cheney should face a televised military tribunal. He, let's say, at the very least, implied that the former Joint Chief of Staff, General Mark Milley, should be executed. He repeatedly mocked the brutal attack of the husband of the former Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. He keeps recently claiming that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, eat their neighbors' pets. I could go on for days. Importantly, this is not just Trump and his surrogates being unhinged. This is a strategy. As Adam Serwer argues in his pointedly titled "The Cruelty is the Point," quote, "Trump's only true skill is the con. His only fundamental belief is that the United States is the birthright of straight white Christian men. And his only real authentic pleasure is in cruelty. It is that cruelty and the delight it brings them that binds his most ardent supporters to him, unquote. Of course, Trump's most extreme act was his refusal to concede that he lost a free and fair election by millions of votes and instead declared the result rigged, which quickly became the rallying cry of "Stop the steal." The violence on display during the attack on the Capitol showed that this rhetoric was literally weaponized, used to convince people they need to overthrow their own government. As Trump told the crowd during his speech right before this insurrection took place, quote, "You're stronger, you're smarter, you've got more going on than anybody, and they try and demean everybody having to do with us. And you're the real people, you're the people that built this nation, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. And we're going to the Capitol, we're going to try and give them the kind of pride and boldness that they need to take back our country," unquote. During their seventh public hearing, the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack presented convincing evidence that Trump's words, particularly a tweet which partially read, quote, "Big protest in D.C. on January 6, be there, will be wild," unquote, encouraged many rioters, including white supremacist groups, such as the already mentioned Proud Boys, but also the Oath Keepers, to not only attend his speech, but storm the Capitol, some of them armed. A 2023 study found that at least 174 defendants implicated in this insurrection specifically cited Trump as their reason for participating in it. And those are the people he wants to pardon now, on day one of his presidency. This may be why this kind of violent rhetoric did not stop with Trump losing the election, but has likely gotten even worse. Here's one example from the 2022 CPAC. At the 2023 Republican State Convention, Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, who extended the Stop the Steal conspiracy by refusing to concede her own election loss, made what she called not a threat, but a public service announcement in reaction to one of Trump's federal indictments. Quote, "If you want to get to President Trump, you're going to have to go through me, and you're going to have to go through 75 million Americans just like me. And I'm going to tell you, most of us are card-carrying members of the NRA. In other words, we are armed." It should come as no surprise that threats of violence against lawmakers and other government employees, as well as election workers, including volunteers, have hit record numbers since Trump took office. Whether Trump himself and how many of his high-level employees and supporters will be held to account legally for their actions and pay a price for their rhetoric with the public, including conservatives, remains to be seen. What we have observed is that currently things are getting worse, not better. What Trump's been saying on the campaign trail is absolutely horrifying. Let me show you just one example. Here's Trump last year on Veterans Day, a federal holiday on which you usually, you know, honor veterans. "We pledge to you that we will root out the communist, Marxist, fascist, and the radical left thugs." Thugs, by the way, is also frequently a dog whistle for black people or people of color that live like vermin among us. Scholars and journalists, we are in Austria here after all, were quick to point out that this echoes the language of past and present dictators, for example, Hitler and Mussolini. And you may also have noticed in the clip that this was scripted. Trump read off a teleprompter. So this wasn't him ad-libbing and going off the rails, not that this would be much better. But again, I do think it is worse if it is a clear strategy. Dehumanize your opponent. And he's also already been preparing his supporters to not accept the election outcome again, should he lose. In 2022, he suggested to, in essence, terminate the Constitution, you know, because he didn't win the election. And it's not just rhetoric. Trump and his Republican allies have actively been working toward upending the election, should they not like the outcome. Election boards across the country now include Trump supporters who believe, or at least claim to believe, that the election was stolen from him. And they've tried to come up with all kinds of new rules and regulations that would allow them to simply not certify the election result in their county or state. In other words, even if Kamala Harris wins, who knows what's actually going to happen? I mean, Trump will call rigged election, millions of his supporters will believe him, there may be violence again, and he may just manage to overturn it this time around. But so what if that happens, or if Trump actually wins? Because yes, that is very much a possibility. Well, he's been light on actual policy proposals. There's really just one thing he's been consistent on. Well, two things: mass deportation of immigrants without due process, and he wants to impose massive tariffs on important goods. He calls it taxing foreign nations. And I mean the Soviet building, right? You know how ridiculous that is. That is not how tariffs work. Other than that, he's been mostly vague. He has, and I quote, concepts of a plan for healthcare. So if you want to find out about policy, though, we need to look elsewhere, specifically the so-called Project 2025, a 900-page how-to-run-an-ultra-conservative government manual championed by the right-wing think tank, the Heritage Foundation. Now, once a number of really unpopular policy proposals included in this manifesto were covered by the media more broadly, Trump tried to distance himself from it. Now, despite the fact that he partly agrees and partly disagrees with a thing he knows nothing about and wishes them good luck even though he finds some stuff abysmal, the fact that he knows nothing about this is not a very believable claim, given that at least 140 of the people involved with this manifesto worked in the Trump administration. The whole thing is up online, freely accessible, but if you don't want to read those 900 pages, let me give you some highlights. Since we are at a university, I assume all you care about education. What does Project 25 say about that? They want to abolish the entire Department of Education and essentially destroy the public school system by funneling money, tax money to, among others, conservative Christian schools. I assume, I hope you care about climate change. They want to break up and downsize NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which includes, among others, the National Weather Service. Why? Because they are, quote, one of the main drivers of the climate change alarm industry, and as such are harmful to future US prosperity, unquote. Project 25 wants to prohibit the FBI from fighting disinformation on social media and turn the position of FBI director into a political appointment like cabinet members are. And in terms of reproductive rights, aka abortion, a major election issues in this election cycle, they have all kinds of ideas. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, should now just rule drugs used for medical abortions that they approved of as unsafe, which would mean they'd be taken off the market. So regardless of abortion policy of a state, they would not be available anymore. Generally, the notion that abortion is healthcare should be rejected, and there would be a pro-life task force to, quote, further the health and well-being of all Americans from conception to natural death, unquote. Finally, and at this point probably unsurprisingly to you, one woman married to one man plus biological children is the, quote, ideal natural family structure, unquote. Besides Project 25, we can, of course, also look at what Trump actually did during his presidency to extrapolate what he would do if he were given a second term. Doing this comprehensively would require its very own lecture or even lecture series. So let me just give you the latest two examples that were reported recently and that we didn't know about. During the heights of the pandemic in 2020, Trump secretly sent COVID tests, you know, at a time when we, no country, had enough of them, to Vladimir Putin. And to be clear, not to the people of Russia, for Putin's personal use. And a few days ago, two people who worked for the Trump administration revealed on record that Trump refused to give disaster relief to California, parts of which were devastated by wildfires, because it is a democratic state. It was only when it was pointed out to him that the specific areas affected were actually fairly Republican that he released financial aid. Similarly, a few years ago, news reports were published that said one reason Trump initially didn't care at all about the COVID outbreak is because it only affected New York, another liberal state. And now he's lying about the recovery efforts in Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas that were devastated by Hurricane Helene, to the extent that even Republican local officials are begging him to stop because he's making the problems worse. Besides this look back, the fact that Trump himself has not communicated a lot of policy proposals on the campaign trail also does not mean that he hasn't articulated some things he'd be doing should he get back into the White House. He's vowed to prosecute his perceived enemies. He will pardon the January 6 attackers, as I mentioned. He said he'd be a dictator, but not to worry, only on day one. And he said these things repeatedly. He didn't misspeak, he wasn't misinterpreted. Clearly this is a feature, not a bug. Many of his supporters like him because, and not despite of that. There is a reason that an unprecedented number of Republicans, people who worked in the Reagan, Bush, and Trump administrations, have endorsed Kamala Harris, including Dick Cheney. Do you remember him? George W. Bush's vice president. Clearly, they believe this election is about more than just left versus right. I think Donald Trump's anti-democratic, unconstitutional tendencies and aspirations are pretty clear. He already tried it during his presidential term, but back then there were still some guardrails that kept him somewhat in check. In a second term, no such guardrails would exist anymore. He learned from these mistakes. He would only appoint an employed loyalist who will do whatever he says, regardless of ethics, morals, and law. Not to mention, to come back to where I started, the Supreme Court essentially gave him license to be a dictator. There's no more check on presidential power, it's almost limitless. So let me close with the end of the dissenting opinion by Sonia Sotomayor, one of the three justices who voted against this kind of presidential immunity. Quote, "Never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity. If the occupant of that office misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide will not provide a backstop. With fear for our democracy, I dissent." Thank you.